This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
After the violence at the University of Virginia last month, colleges around the country began to review applications for events ever more cautiously, trying to balance the obvious claim to free speech on campus against the possibilities of disruption and harm to students. Emotions are particularly high at the University of California, Berkeley, where a conservative student group called the Berkeley Patriot has invited Ann Coulter, Steve Bannon, and the alt-right provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos to campus. It's an event they're calling Free Speech Week. Melissa Murray is a professor of law at Berkeley. She was on campus the last time Milo Yiannopoulos was there and was invited to speak, and protesters smashed windows and set fires. I asked her to describe what that event was like.
So I, at the time, was the interim dean of the law school. One thing they don't tell you when you sign up to be the interim dean is, like the captain of the ship, you've got to make sure everyone's good to go before you leave the building in a situation like that. And so I left the law school building. It was dark. It was winter. And as soon as I drove out of the garage, you could hear helicopters overhead. I mean, just very loud helicopters everywhere. You'd been hearing helicopters all day long, but it just seemed like there were more of them, and it was incredibly loud. And I turned out of the garage onto the road, and there were just people everywhere. And, you know, trying to maneuver your car through these throngs of people chanting and screaming. You know, at one point, you know, people are slamming on the hood of the car, and you know, people are throwing bottles, like there's glass. I mean, you just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there were these moments where I just sort of wondered, I mean, am I going to get home in one piece tonight? And, you know, later we learned that a lot of these protesters were sort of coming in from the outside. They weren't members of the Berkeley community.
This is the Antifa or anti-fascist movement.
I guess. I mean, that's what they're called. They're definitely external to the university. And you know, I think if things had sort of progressed the way that they appear to have been going earlier in the day, it would have been students sort of expressing discontent, being angry, but not necessarily being violent. I mean, it really tipped over into a different level, the likes of which I hadn't seen. And I will say, if you've been at Berkeley for 12 years, you've seen a protest or two. This was like nothing I'd ever seen.
But you hear this all the time in the media now, not just from conservative commentators, that somehow on campus there's an atmosphere now that people to the left, snowflakes as they're called, are so sensitive that they don't want to hear from the likes of Ann Coulter or Larry Ingraham or whoever the speaker may be from the right or the Trump right or the alt-right.
Right. I mean, I think that is warranted to some extent. There are certainly students and faculty members and staff and administrators who may be resistant to hearing ideas that are not consistent with their own. But I think for the most
part— What's their rationale, and do you buy it?
Well, so some people have noted that, especially with someone like Ann Coulter, who I think is, you know, really more of a provocateur than a scholar, that when she speaks, she actually engages in a lot of epithets, making sort of broad claims about different groups that are not necessarily supported by evidence and are, you know, really sort of unkind and mean, and she's doing it purposely. I could see that, but I just want to be clear. I've been at Berkeley for 12 years, and I've seen a number of speakers whose views do not cohere with my own who have come through. Charles Murray came through. The law school's had a number of conservative legal thinkers through our Federalist Society. So this idea that Berkeley is somehow hostile or resistant to viewpoints that don't cohere with some so-called Berkeley orthodoxy, I think, is patently false.
A conservative student group at Berkeley has invited Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter to speak on campus later this month. It's part of something called Free Speech Week. You're here in NYU for the term.
Yeah.
Is it a mistake for the school, for Berkeley, to host those speakers, given what's happened in the past? The mayor of Berkeley thinks it is.
Yes. I think the administration is really between a rock and a hard place. Berkeley has a very long and deep tradition of being receptive to free speech. It's the birthplace of the free speech movement. I don't really think the administration has a lot of wiggle room here. I mean, if you say that you are for free speech, you have to be for free speech, and that includes even speech that you might find offensive. I do think when these, you know, when free speech tips over into violence, I think that's a moment where the university administration can and should act. And I think it has acted in the past to protect students, to protect demonstrators, to ensure public safety, and to make sure that it doesn't spill over into the kind of things that we saw in February.
You're a law professor. I'm a journalist. I grew up with a certain sense of almost an absolute belief in freedom of speech. Maybe you the same. Do you find that your students are different in some ways when it comes to speech?
There have been a lot of times where I felt every inch of my 40-something years, where I'm turning into a stodgy old person.
How so? Because you're hearing what?
Well, so I will give you an anecdote from constitutional law, which I have taught at Berkeley for a number of years now. You know, I had a student a number of years ago come to me and just very, very upset. And, you know, of course, you know, what's going on? So-and-so in class said something that it was just so discriminatory and so offensive. And I was sort of racking my brain, what was said in class? I mean, because I usually am pretty attuned to things going, the dynamics of the classroom. And, you know, if someone sort of says something that's really out of line, I will say something in class, like, you know, that's not appropriate. Let's keep it evidence-based. But this student was really angry because we had had a discussion about affirmative action, which I thought had gone very well, given how polarizing that issue can be. And I felt that students ventilated both sides of the argument and were very thoughtful about it. And she was so upset that a student had said that she did not believe in affirmative action. And, you know, she was like, this was so discriminatory. And I was caught off guard because I felt myself sort of, you know, immediately becoming defensive. And I was like, wait a minute, I need you to tell me how it's discriminatory. She's like, well, it means that she doesn't think I belong here. It means that she thinks I don't belong. I'm like, you're personalizing something. All she said was that she doesn't agree with affirmative action.
As a policy.
As a policy. And like, it doesn't have to be about you. Maybe it is, but she didn't personalize it. But like, you know, where is this coming from? And then, you know, we're talking about this. And finally, I just kind of tipped my hand. Like, you may not agree with it. I may not agree with it. But it is a legitimate position that you can take. And it is entirely legitimate
so how
to raise it in class.
How is a student like that getting to that conclusion? What has happened in her background in education, and I don't doubt the sincerity of it, that she reaches the conclusion that that speech should not be permissible in a law school seminar?
Perhaps, I mean, it does feel personal. There may be, I think this is true. I mean, I, you know, have felt this as an African-American woman, as a student. Like, you know, when the day comes to discuss affirmative action and constitutional law, it's like, oh my God, this is the day where I have to justify being here or like show that
there's a sense of dread a little bit.
Yes. And, you know, so I think there was a way in which it was deeply personal to her, and to express opposition to affirmative action was conflated with expressing opposition to her. And, you know, I don't know if it was meant that way. And, you know, maybe it was. Like, she could have been right. But as a professor, I think it's really important that a student be able to say, you know what, I have questions about this. I don't agree with that position. I think this is a legitimate position to have. And, you know, if it's not, help me to understand why it's not.
We're living through a political moment that's charged in a million different ways. Racially is one way. And I wonder how you view what happened in Charlottesville in light of your own experience in Berkeley.
So I'm a graduate of the University of Virginia. So I spent 4 years living in Charlottesville, the last year of which I lived on the lawn, which is the historic part of those grounds that are designed by Thomas Jefferson.
Honored students are placed on the lawn.
Well, allegedly. These are the honored students who don't mind not having a bathroom for a whole year.
Well, you're young.
For me, the year I lived on the lawn, I think I was one of a handful of students of color who were living there. And, you know, I remember that year someone wrote the N-word on my door, and it was such a jarring experience. And to see, you know, 20 years later, people marching with open flames on the lawn, like, what would it have been like for a student of color coming back to the university in 2 weeks and already feeling like, you know, a little bit discombobulated, being living in a place that was built by slaves? And, you know, we've only recently begun to acknowledge that contribution at the university, to then be living there having just witnessed this act.
Did the incidents at Berkeley and Charlottesville have anything in common?
Surely, which is, you know, I think interesting because Berkeley and Charlottesville, having been in both places for a number of years, could not be more different in terms of their ethos. I think of Charlottesville and the universities being very pro-institutions. I mean, in Charlottesville, you talk about Thomas Jefferson like he's gone out for ice and he'll be back any minute. At Berkeley, it's very anti-institutionalist, iconoclastic in a way that Charlottesville is not, but yet I think they're united as being flashpoints for a kind of culture war that I think is coming to a head. And it's a little frightening. You know, in Berkeley, on the one hand, it's this question of free speech and whether free speech can be used to cloak discrimination, bigotry. And, you know, in Charlottesville, it's this larger question of how do we repair a past that for many is deeply uncomfortable and laced with the vestiges of discrimination and segregation, and how do we reconcile that? And I think all of this is sort of united. Like, we as a country have not really done the hard work of reconciling our past, and, you know, we paper over it. But then there are these moments where the wounds come open again, and they're coming open in Berkeley, they're coming open in Charlottesville.
Melissa Murray is a professor of law at Berkeley.